This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Lee Bell at St. Joseph's University, and today I'm joined by Dr. Chris Blakely to discuss his new book, Empire of Brutality, Enslaved People and Animals in the British Atlantic World, published by Louisiana State University Press in 2023. Historians of early America, slavery, early African American history, history of science and environmental history have interrogated the complex ways in which enslaved people were thought about and treated as human, but also dehumanized to be understood as private property or chattel. The comparison of enslaved people to animals, particularly dogs, cattle, or horses, was a common device deployed by enslavers. The letters, memoirs, and philosophical treatises of the enslaved and formerly enslaved reveal the complex ways in which enslaved people analyzed and fought these comparisons. Dr. Chris Blakely focuses on human-animal relationships to unpack how, where, and when did such decisions regarding the chattel nature of human captives take place. In Empire of Brutality, they argue that slaving and slavery relied on and generated complex human-animal networks and relations. Exploring these groupings leads to a deeper understanding of how enslavers worked out the process of turning people into chattel and laid the foundations of slavery by mingling enslaved people with non-human animals. Efforts to remake people into property akin to animals involved exchange and trade, scientific fieldwork that exploited curiosity and forms of labor. Using the correspondence of the Royal African Company, specimen catalogs and scientific papers of the Royal Society, plantation inventories and manuals, and diaries kept by slaveholders, Dr. Blakely describes human-animal networks spanning from Britain's slave castles and outposts throughout Western Africa to plantations in the Caribbean and the American Southeast. They combine approaches from environmental history, history of science, and philosophy to examine slavery from the ground up and from the perspectives of the enslaved. Dr. Chris Blakely is a visiting assistant professor in the CORE program at Occidental College and a historian interested in more than human relationships with a focus on racialization and empire building. Empire of Brutality, Enslaved People and Animals in the British American Atlantic World is their first book, and they're just beginning a second project on science, race, and the senses in the 19th century. I'm delighted to welcome them to the New Books Network.
Hi, Susan. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you for that very kind introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm looking forward to the conversation.
It's a great book. I enjoyed reading it so much. It's hard to read. There's a lot in here that, you know, we all have to grapple with. But This is a beautifully written book. It's a fascinating book. It's very hard to actually put it down. And you know, I'd say that about many academic monographs. And I also want to call out what a gracious author you are. All of the authors who are listening to the podcast should read the acknowledgments to this book. They are a model for sort of this gracious signaling of the roles of your colleagues, of institutions, of grants. Oh, I loved when you said conversations and kind words of family. And all of this always goes into a book. And the way you put that together, terrific. So thank you. And I'm sure the people who, you know, were with you along the way appreciated it too. But it's a great model for authors. But I do want to ask you, how did you come to this topic? Like, how did you come to the writing of this particular book? How did it grow out of the research that you had done previously in graduate school? Why this book?
Sure. So I was originally interested in the history of science in the 18th century. And I was writing this book in the 2010s, so between like 2013 and 2019 or so. And in the history of science, there's been a lot of really interesting research on subaltern peoples as contributing to and shaping and really being foundations of early modern science. So that's where I started, as I was trying to find evidence of enslaved people in the 18th century British Atlantic, looking at places like slave castles, plantations, and trying to find where enslaved people were collecting specimens that later went on to become the kind of central collections of institutions like the British Museum, the University of Cambridge, and other academic museums. So that was where my interest began. And I was finding people in the archive, in my primary sources, like an enslaved man named Oxford, who I write about in the book, who collected animals and collected and preserved these specimens. And that was where I started. So I was really interested in curiosity and the role that Atlantic African people's curiosity played in what previously and still kind of contestedly is called the scientific revolution. So that's where I started. And I was going to write a project basically about the history of science and enslaved people. And my advisor at the time was cautioning me to think about maybe a broader story. And so from there, I started to think about, okay, well, what other forms of human-animal interactions can I write about that are not only constitutive of, you know, scientific knowledge, but maybe economic profits. And so that's when I got interested in trying to figure out what other connections existed between slaves and animals in the castle trade, but also on plantations that were pretty familiar to historians of British America, colonial America. So that's really where it all began, was history of science.
And tell people what castle trade is. I mentioned it earlier and I should have defined it, but I'll have you define it because you'll do a better job.
Yeah, so the castle trade refers to the phase of the slave trade involving the exchange of human captives between slavers in Atlantic Africa and English slavers on castles like Cape Coast Castle, on the Gold Coast in West Africa, but also in the Bight of Benin. So the term castle trade is something of a misnomer in that it privileges these kind of like large castles like Cape Coast. But if you look through the correspondence of the Royal African Company, which was the British monopoly slave trading company in the late 17th century, there are letters written by people at outforts, small forts along the coastline, where these merchants or slave trading factors receive captives, and then they exchange them for goods, and then they forward them to Cape Coast, the central castle. People who were enslaved would have been waiting, detained, incarcerated at this castle for months at a time before passing through the door of no return, leading them out of the dungeons of the castle and then onto ships. And so once people were loaded onto the ship, then begins the middle passage. So the castle trade, you can also think of it as like the first passage, the process of being captured and enslaved and traded, that then is followed by the middle passage and the final passage.
And I just want to say that this calling our attention to animals and people is unbelievably illuminating. I've read and actually taught some of the documents that you present in the book. And I have to say that reading your book made me think, how did I not see that? How did I not see? I took away the dehumanizing piece in a kind of a vague way, but I didn't interrogate further. So I just want to say, for those people who do these documents, this is an incredibly important book, you know, to grapple with. I mentioned dehumanizing, and the title is Empire of Brutality. So I want to start with this notion of dehumanization and how it's important to the project, but also why it's important to note the potential pitfalls about talking about dehumanization, the ones that you're actually trying very, very hard and I think very effectively to avoid in the book.
So the way that I look at dehumanization is through the work of David Livingstone Smith, who's a philosopher. Dehumanization refers to the denial or the diminishment of one's humanity. And I think that it's been kind of a commonplace for early American historians and historians of African American history that slavery was a fundamentally dehumanizing process and dehumanizing institution that kind of relied on diminishing people's humanity. But like as you mentioned, right, there is an older literature, what is called the quote unquote Sambo thesis, articulated by Stanley Elkins, that enslaved people were mentally, psychologically obliterated by the process of being enslaved. And so that literature really kind of emphasized a concept of dehumanization that was sort of like people lost, you know, their identity, they lost their language. It was also this kind of story of loss, right? And a generation of scholars, you know, people like Gwendolyn Midloe Hall and Walter Rucker really kind of pushed back against this beginning in the 1980s, the 1990s, sort of carefully showing that, you know, people of African descent retained their language, their ideas, their beliefs, their ways of knowing the natural world and religion and philosophy. So when I use the term dehumanization, I'm not referring to this idea that enslaved people were, you know, so psychically traumatized as to be unable to kind of be independent people. What I'm trying to refer to is an always incomplete process by which slavers and slaveholders try to diminish the humanity of people of African descent who are captives, and try to create this kind of ideological justification for slavery by comparing people to animals, and by dehumanizing them kind of on an everyday basis. So that's what I'm trying to do, is look for that sort of like fundamentally kind of always incomplete and always provisional process.
And you have lots of ways of showing the various ways, because it's complicated, that slavers and even people who didn't own slaves but were invested in the hierarchy depicted the relationship in visual culture. For example, you have a remarkable section on portraits and how people were painted, in which you try to get at how these depictions make this more nuanced, that sometimes the depiction of an enslaved person is about the extension of the so-called owner's body or their power. Sometimes the paintings are shown so that there's an equivalency between an animal, like a horse, that's doing a job that somebody doesn't want to do, and so therefore they could have an enslaved person do it or an animal do it. Sometimes you talk about how the paintings show enslaved people as just like an exotic curiosity, as something like a parrot, like something that is there. And sometimes it's not just about being exotic. It's about being tame or being, a pet of some sort. And you have this phenomenal section. It's really one of my favorites about how all of these hierarchies are just subtly and not so subtly, depicted in art. But you never say, and so you see this as very, very important to the way Europeans are viewing themselves, but you actually never have the enslaved people fully accepting this. In fact, what you have is incredibly powerful documents that show that, in fact, they don't, that they notice what's being done. They notice that this is how they are being described, and they push back on that. And I was wondering if you would just talk about the opening of the book and the incredible letter that's being sent, and again, how enslaved people themselves are speaking about this relationship between enslavers, animals, and themselves.
Yeah, so the letter you're mentioning that the book opens with was written by a group of people in 1723 in Virginia. And we don't really know much of anything about these people. We know that they were a group of both literate and non-literate people, probably men and women, older and younger people. But it's addressed to Edmund Gibson, who had recently been appointed the Archbishop of London, the head of the Anglican Church. And it's a letter that other historians have looked at. But one thing that I really fixate on in reading the letter is that the letter writers write to the Archbishop that they are being treated, quote, as if we were dogs. And this is in a kind of longer section about sort of the ways in which enslaved people are treated. They mention, being denied observing the Sabbath, being denied marriage, being denied religious instruction. But they end the letter by saying, we are being treated as if we are like these dogs, right? So I thought it was a really important intellectual critique of dehumanization, and one that I think should be taken seriously by intellectual historians. One thing that when I was reading this letter, the question kind of came up of people asked me, is it possible that this is a letter written by an abolitionist, a white abolitionist, or is it possible this is a letter maybe written by an enslaved person, but they are being coached? And I really think that is unlikely and not the case. Abolitionism was not a popular ideology or popular position in the early 18th century. And also, I think that this is part of a larger Black philosophical canon of kind of attacks of dehumanization that are from lived experience, from actually being enslaved. And I think that it deserves our attention as much as any other text that is a kind of logically rigorous, reasoned argument against slavery, specifically kind of highlighting this dehumanizing quality of being enslaved.
And it's also part of a sort of a wider not infinite number of letters that take this shape. The petition to the governors of Massachusetts that make very, quasi-Lockean arguments about why it is that, they should not be treated as they are being treated. Also similarly, we can't practice Christianity. We can't abide by certain requirements of marriage without this. So it's not one letter. You do a great job in the book, I think, of sort of showing all of the different types of voices that we do have from this period, and that it's not one letter. There are many. There are different types, and I think that's the method that you use, the types of documents, the incredible diversity of evidence that you present in the book is really one of its great strengths. And instead of it making it hard to read because you're pulling from so many different places. In fact, I think it makes the argument simpler, more powerful, easier for me as a reader who's not history of science to read it. So, you know, thank you very much for doing that. When do we see these kind of categories of like the human and the animal take shape? Is this something that just is American? Is this something that's just British? How far long does this go back? And is there something very particular, though, in this British Atlantic tradition?
So that's a hard question. It's one that I think like anyone who studies animal history has to deal with, is sort of like, when does the concept of human and animal come into being? I think that, you know, if you look back to like antiquity, right, people have noticed that Aristotle makes a kind of clear definition between people who are, you know, natural slaves, and he describes them as being animal-like. I think that in the period that I'm looking at, you know, some of the key signs of full humanity within, you know, the Anglophone world are, you know, reason, worshiping God, obeying God's commands, and also having kind of control over the natural world, which includes animals. That's a point that's made by Erica Fudge, which I think is useful for sort of looking at the 18th century specifically. But one point that I do make early in the introduction of the book is that comparing people to animals or dehumanizing people through animalization, you know, it does have its roots in a much older history. So, for example, like medieval historians have looked at the ways in which Europeans dehumanized Jewish people as being, you know, quote unquote dog-like or quote unquote animal-like. And it's not necessarily unique to the history of slavery itself, right? So in the context of Indian slavery, the enslavement of indigenous Americans, both in South America and North America, Europeans certainly dehumanized Native Americans, but also within indigenous American cultures, there's even sort of ideas about enslaved people as being animal-like, as being less than human, or something kind of between human and animal did exist. I think the thing with Atlantic slavery and with this enslavement of people of African descent by the British, and specifically the late 17th century to the early 19th century, is that it is a system that spans three continents and does kind of require to some extent a pretty hefty ideological justification. And it's also, I think, one that comes from, you know, the material conditions on the ground. So that was one thing that I really wanted to show in the book, is that dehumanization as a process doesn't purely begin from the mind or from like intellectual justifications, but actually comes about from what's really happening, you know, when people are being purchased as enslaved captives, when scientific research is being conducted in the field, and also when agricultural fortunes are being made on plantation islands like Barbados or in the Chesapeake in Virginia or Maryland. So I think that what I was able to do is sort of find how a kind of material basis of dehumanization came about and led to and interacted with this kind of intellectual layer.
I also want to talk about the structure of the book, and then we're going to get to the meat of the argument. So a lot of history books are chronological, and a lot of museums and books about enslavement and slavery are also chronological, but that you reject that. And you actually use this image of like zigzagging, and that there is not some sort of little linear story that gets told. It's much more complicated. And to reflect that complication, you do the chapters not in chronological order, but in terms of these big themes that you think are important. And they all involve the relationships between animals and humans and enslaved people and enslavers. But I'd like you to talk just a tiny bit about that decision to organize it that way, and then we'll talk about some of these amazing chapters.
So my theoretical framework is adopted from the work of Marcy Norton, who is a historian of human-animal relationships also. And she uses the term mode of interaction to describe specific ways of interacting with animals between people and animals. And so she actually really encouraged me to think about modes of interaction as a kind of organizing principle for the book. And I think it was really helpful and useful to think about it that way, because, like, as you said, trying to think about it chronologically, I would always kind of run into this issue of, well, do I need to go back to the 16th century? Should I go into the late 19th century? Like, how far should the story be? And I think the framework of modes of interaction let me focus on specific chronological periods, but without, you know, pushing on like an teleology, right? Sort of like trying to say, like, well, it began here, like this was the first instance of dehumanization, but once you get to the end of the story, it's over, right? Like, I don't think I could have done a kind of neat story like that. So the theory of modes of interaction was really helpful. And so that kind of let me organize the book in terms of the things that I focus on in the first kind of half of the book are exchange, people being exchanged for animals, curiosity, people's curiosity being exploited to identify animals, and then labor, right? People's work and their body, their muscle power being used up alongside animals. And so I think that allowed me to tell a kind of material history of slavery that led to dehumanization that I don't think I could have done if I tried to sort of follow a strict chronological arc.
And I also love the way the modes allow you to shift the chronology when necessary to the mode. In other words, in some cases, it is necessary for you to go back a little farther, and you do that. And in other cases, you are focusing somewhere else. But because it's the mode rather than the chronology, it doesn't have that sort of thin feeling of like, well, there's not that much of one of the modes in this year, but we still have to go through it. So I really appreciated that as a reader. Let's go to the first mode, which has to do with the castle trade in West Africa and the ways in which humans and animals are being traded. And again, we will never be able to capture all of the richness of this book. And I just want to encourage people who are listening, this is a book to buy, and you will read it because it's hard not to read it, but we're not going to be able to get to everything. So with that in mind, like, what's the kind of, you know, the kernel for you in these issues of animals and humans together in the castle trade?
So one of the most common forms of currency on the Atlantic coast of West Africa, specifically in the Bight of Benin, present-day Benin and Nigeria as well, was Monetaria moneta, the money cowrie, right, which was a small marine animal from the Indian Ocean. And the money cowrie was used in the slave trade to purchase, by English slavers, to purchase Atlantic African captives. And so something that I really kind of focus on in the book is just sort of how ubiquitous and critical the money cowrie was to enabling trade. The money cowrie was a currency, but also sometimes it was a prestige gift. Sometimes it was also taken as a kind of sign of trust between people. It figures in the cosmologies of several different groups in the Gold Coast and Bight of Benin. By the end of my story, chronologically, enslaved people themselves are kind of articulating their own ideas about being fed, that is, like, given to the money cowries, which they believe, you know, will eat them and will consume their bodies and then multiply. So looking at the money cowrie and cowrie shells in the trade really kind of helped me see how enslaved people kind of saw their own dehumanization happening. And then I also look at animals that were given as gifts, sometimes for sacrificial offerings, but also sometimes just animals that were given as prestige gifts. And so one of the people that I look at in the book very briefly is a young boy named John Favorite, who, for example, was given as a gift along with several different animals to an English slaver in the Gambia. And these include, you know, like ostriches, and then crocodiles, I think, and different kinds of birds. And so, you know, even kind of being given as a gift from one person to another, along with animals probably destined for menageries, I think kind of let me see another aspect of people who were enslaved kind of witnessing their own comparison to an equivalence with non-human animals.
And you have examples of people noticing this and understanding it even as it's happening, which I think are really fascinating. In terms of, and you've mentioned this collecting, I want to push you a little bit more on this idea of the origins of early modern science, you know, being wrapped up, right, in the slave trade, but also in the curiosity of the people who are being enslaved, and say a little bit more about that. You mentioned in the opening, in your opening comment, about people collecting things that ended up in these museums that we're still looking at. But I without reading the book, it's hard to understand fully that. So flesh that out a little bit more, and as to why it's so important of this idea. You call the chapter "Showing Their Slaves How to Collect."
Yeah, so the name of the chapter actually comes from instructions by a naturalist to a slaveholder, and basically the idea is that planters often, but also people like in colonial places like Virginia, but also in the cattle trade too, in the Gold Coast, were often instructed by metropolitan naturalists or scientists to then instruct further enslaved people to go out and collect animal specimens. So this wasn't just animal specimens. There is a really great new book also by Kate Murphy on botanical specimen collecting by enslaved people. So we know that, you know, scientists use the networks of the slave trade to collect natural specimens in general. One of the people that I started to sort of follow early in the research was a missionary to Barbados in the mid-18th century named Griffith Hughes. And he worked with and exploited an enslaved person to collect sea snails and sea different like marine specimens on the northern part of the island. And the thing that kind of really struck me when I was just sort of reading the source for the first time is that he doesn't mention this person by name, but he mentions him as his quote-unquote dog. And that just sort of like connected to me with the letter that I opened the book with, and sort of this idea of enslaved people being kind of seen as an extension of the slaver's mind, right, or as part of their body, or as a loyal kind of vassal animal. So the collections that I'm looking at, like you mentioned, you know, these are specimens that were, first of all, this kind of like new and interesting for Europeans. They had just sort of a quality of being exotic in that sense. But some of them actually go on to become really important collections for understanding debates about like the difference between a plant or an animal. So some of the collections that I look at involving a naturalist who is also a manager for a slaveholder, John Ellis, Those later kind of were part of scientific debates about, you know, key issues in biology, like what's the difference between a plant and an animal. And then, you know, there's someone that I write about in the book that other historians have written about too, which is a person who is only known to us as a quote-unquote black servant. This was a person sent out by Alexander Garden from South Carolina to a small island in the Caribbean, the island of Providence, Providence Island. Anyways, his collections go on to the Swedish taxonomist Linnaeus, and they are part of, you know, his grand effort at sort of producing scientific taxonomy of natural objects. So, you know, I think that thinking about early modern science as the result of the curiosity of people of African descent is just really surprising. And for like historians of science, like it's really powerful to think that like all of these collections, you know, have parts that are from people who were considered to be chattel property and considered to be sort of between animal and human. And I think it does sort of shift the story of how we think about the origins of science and what has been called the scientific revolution. One of the last thing I'll say real quick just about this point is through the networks of one particular slave trading company called the South Sea Company, surgeons would often send animal specimens from the factories. They're called factories, but they're basically like depots where enslaved people are being held until they're sold. But these surgeons would send back animal specimens, and sometimes they included, you know, taxidermy sloths, for example, but also then sometimes the human remains of enslaved people, enslaved children. And so there's a candidate for even further comparison there of enslaved people's bodies and their remains being turned into specimens that kind of then move along the same routes as the animal specimens that they had been collecting.
No, and it's sort of brilliantly described in the book, this idea that, you know, when we collect things, especially when we're collecting them by hand, then it's your eye. It's your decision as the collector, the person who is walking through the environment, whatever it is, to make those decisions. That's what makes the collection, and that's what means that that particular person is, in a sense, the author of the collection. No, it's an incredible chapter. I loved it. The third chapter in the first part of the book is about labor, and here you're focusing on American plantations. So you've mentioned a little bit about, and you use this word in the book, quoting from a document of the time, drudgery, this idea that animals and enslaved peoples are used for certain work. But say a little bit more about how this modality of labor functions in the chapter.
Sure. So one of the key texts for me is a book written by a planter from Antigua named Samuel Morton. He wrote a kind of manual for planters after rebuilding his family's plantations in the mid-18th century. And in the manual, like on the very first page of this new guide for people who are going to become, you know, taking over their family's plantations, he says, enslaved people, cattle, mules, and horses are to be considered the nerves of a plantation. And then another contemporary of Martin's similarly writes that they are the sinews of the plantation. So there's this anatomical rhetoric that compares enslaved people and animals to parts of the body that connect the mind to the limbs and also move muscle between bone. So this rhetoric kind of, I think, reflects the centrality of human-animal labor on plantations and also their equivalency. So in this chapter, I really look at how enslaved people are kind of exhausted by plantation labor. So labor in sugar plantations or on wheat and tobacco plantations looked quite different, but this labor involved people working with animals, often as draft animals through plowing, but also just everyday labor with animals, like feeding animals. And planters, I think, really tried to systematically kind of equate their bodies at every possible turn. So one of the things that I look at is proposed diets that are nearly identical for enslaved people and animals that often involved like a purely kind of grain-based diet of just like oats or just corn. And slaveholders kind of always expected that enslaved people would kind of hunt or fish to to substantiate their diet, right? Like they never provided or rarely provided animal meat. And so enslaved people were kind of like always forced to really kind of like supplement what was essentially like a malnourishing diet. And then the last thing I kind of look at in terms of relationships through labor is the accumulation of both human and animal waste to refertilize and revitalize plantations. The thing that I think is really valuable about that chapter is that it just kind of zooms in on how everyday life under enslavement in both the Caribbean and the Chesapeake involved working with animals, caring for animals, watching after animals, so much so that in these manuals written by, you know, these aristocratic planters who kind of envision them as being scientific manuals, really just see them as purely kind of equivalent, but also kind of critical to the operations of a plantation. The other thing I looked at through in this chapter was wills. So one thing people kind of encouraged me to look at were wills, and you know, wills list property to be inherited. And these are also another kind of document I looked at is probate inventories. And, you know, this is something that wasn't original to my research, but something that I found from both of these regions is people bequeathing both enslaved people and animals and kind of listing them, you know, number by number, like pound for pound, how much they were worth. So in that sense, you know, I think it's pretty obvious from the plantation labor regimes that this kind of dehumanizing equation was always at work.
And it's interesting because if you think about the paintings and you think about the wills, right, we have this sort of these you know, granular, bureaucratic, pound for pound, and then we have these sort of artistic, but they're all aimed at sort of creating these hierarchies in very similar ways. And I love the way you connect all of these things throughout the book. It's really one of its strengths. The last half of the book is dedicated more to thinking about how it is that enslaved people, despite all of this, resisted, sabotaged, used some of the assumptions of their enslavers for their, you know, to find small places in which to push back, to craft their own relationships with their families, et cetera, despite all of the legal challenges to that. And I was wondering if you could say a little bit first about chapter 4, which is called By One Babardi or Another, Sabotage Slave Resistance and Animals, and just talk a little bit about that. It's kind of it's the big turn in the book, I think.
Yeah, so sabotage in the sense of sort of upsetting industrial production is something that I thought was really important for my story, because when enslaved people injured or killed livestock animals, they were engaging in sabotage, in the undermining of a slaveholder's goals for agricultural production. So I was really fascinated by instances of enslaved people using the environment and environmental knowledge in particular to injure, maim, or kill animals. And an example of this is enslaved people would wait until after, you know, days of heavy rain, and then use, you know, pathways in ways that they could anticipate, you know, an animal might lose its footing and fall and injure itself, or fall and, you know, die. Snow also in particular was something that people used, right? Like waiting for snow and then using snow and snowy landscape as a way to kind of put animals in danger and at harm's way. And I think, you know, historians have looked at this too and said, like, this is resistance, it's sabotage. But I think what I wanted to say is that there's also kind of an intellectual choice behind this to kind of seek out, like, what are the tools that the slaveholder requires and relies on? How can an enslaved person break them in such a way that, you know, slows down production or halts production, but also challenges dehumanization, challenges this idea that enslaved people are less than rational or animal-like, right? These are like very strategic decisions being made. There are also decisions where, you know, an animal is often killed and then eaten by enslaved people to supplement their, you know, awful diet. So that's another thing that I kind of wanted to zoom in on with this. I think thinking about resistance and like killing animals in particular, it's an important kind of intellectual critique of slavery and an intellectual aspect of resistance that I think has often been overlooked or maybe just not theorized as a rebuke to dehumanization.
And you talk about throughout the book this idea that Europeans have that part of what makes humans humans is that, you know, God gave them this right to make decisions to use animals in this way. So when enslaved peoples are in fact using animals for their own devices, i.e. to feed themselves, to increase their as you say, these diets that were sometimes limited because they were being treated like animals, the number of loops that are being done. So because they're treated like animals and only fed grain, they're in need of the nutrition, which can be gained from killing an animal. And in killing the animal, they're demonstrating the qualities that the Christian Europeans are saying of what makes them human, even as they're being dehumanized. So, and you make all these connections so clear. So it's and the examples are so stark and nuanced. And I don't think we would see them if we were not focusing on the human animal relationship, which is what you're asking us to do. The last chapter in the book is called She Has Bragged: Fugitives, Animals, and the Limits of Slavery. And you're very careful about gender throughout the book. And this is every page of this book is very, very nuanced. And I probably should have said at the start that you're also very careful about vocabulary, and you're careful about naming words that you're going to use that are nevertheless incredibly fraught and that historians have been trying to define in ways that will never be satisfactory. And you know, examples you give are human, humanity, animal, animality, human-animal binary, human-animal relationship. And I guess I should have said that. And I think some of that comes out in chapter 5, because I think you, by this point, have brought all of it home and can have demonstrated some of the sort of, you know, again, the slipperiness in all of each of these concepts and the nuances in each. So anyway, say a little bit about the end of this book, why you ended it here, and, you know, the importance of this chapter.
Yeah, so the last chapter in the book is about a corpus of fugitive advertisements where slaveholders are trying to arrest and recapture an enslaved person. I found over 100 advertisements that involve an enslaved person stealing a horse to ride away. And I think these are really important advertisements and really important documents. So they're important for a few reasons. One is they tell us a lot about the ways in which enslaved people imagine space. So when an enslaved person stole a horse, they often would use it to ride to family in another town or another plantation. They also would use it sometimes in the sense of like riding the horse to then get to a stream or a river and then take a boat to somewhere else. Sometimes they also use them to find like ports and to try to escape by boat to another island. And so like stealing a horse, I think, reflects like a really serious environmental knowledge or geographical knowledge that we shouldn't underestimate. The second thing that I think is really important is that, you know, it's an extremely dramatic and kind of daring thing to do. Stealing a horse requires, I think, you know, the knowledge of sort of like how to ride and how to deal with horses, and how to sort of, you know, successfully mount the horse. And also like just the sort of act of stealing a horse and riding someone else's horse, in the context of like English cultural history in the 17th and 18th centuries, you know, it's literally, not literally, but it's emasculating, right? It's like stealing your slaveholder's, you know, most prized animal that is also kind of like an extension of their masculinity and their manhood. And so I did find examples, there's only a few in this corpus that I'm looking at, but I did find examples of women especially that I wanted to focus on who stole horses to ride away. And I think that, like, you know, if you want to look at these women seriously as intellectual actors, I think that there must be something there about, like, consciously taking the reins, you know, getting into the saddle or maybe not and riding away, that is really something like an intellectual critique. Also, you know, people talk about slavery and sort of like the verticality of slavery, right? Like the slaveholder or the overseer rides on horseback and the enslaved person kind of walks on foot. So, you know, stealing the horse totally flips the vertical normal operations of slavery. And then the thing that I'll say, like, at the end, or last thing I'll say for now, you know, there's, I don't remember exactly how many, but there's a really startling number of these advertisements involving someone stealing a horse and they're a person with a disability, people who have been injured due to work, people whose, like, thigh or knee or, you know, their leg is injured in some way. But then also people who are missing, who have lost, you know, toes or fingers, who clearly, like, have been exposed to, like, environmental danger and risk, probably through, like, frostbite. And so, like, choosing to steal a horse is a way to sort of, you know, I don't know, compensate or just, like, sort of extend one's body through the animal, right? And, like, I think that was something that I really didn't expect to see, and it surprised me, but people with disabilities stealing horses to ride away, I just thought was so interesting and so powerful. And like, you know, I certainly never encountered these kinds of materials when I was studying American history. So I found this sort of creative kind of thought about stealing horses just to be so interesting and so powerful. And yeah, that's, I thought that was a really kind of important note to end on, is like people using these animals for their own liberation and their own family connections and their own agency and their own purpose.
You mentioned, you know, coming across all of these ads that speak directly to, you know, somebody who took a horse and some of the other documentation about people who are disabled. Was there another aha, like, you know, moment of a document that really just was striking to you in the creation of this book? Like, just a moment that you'll never forget there?
I guess one of them is from the epilogue of the book. So I teach Mary Prince's autobiography, The History of Mary Prince. I teach the early American history class. And, you know, she writes about work on in Bermuda and in the Turks and Caicos Islands. She writes about, like, you know, learning the work of being an enslaved woman involves, like, cleaning the horse, feeding the horse, taking care of the chickens, like feeding them, you know, cleaning all the animals. And she sleeps in, like, the horse's stable. And she just says, like, in her memoir, just this, like, really amazing sentence is just like, this is slavery, you know, like this three words, this is slavery. And, you know, I think that, like, for me, I had thought about that for a while. And I think I thought, you know, it's just like maybe a point that needed to be kind of emphasized, that, like, we all kind of take for granted or just kind of take it as a given that slavery was violent, brutal, dehumanizing. But the extent to which it kind of comes from these real, like, on the ground material relationships, I think was something that hadn't been sort of looked at by someone maybe from the background of, like, history of science, environmental history. So that was, for me, kind of an aha moment of, like, you know, this is slavery. Yeah.
No, and I think it's terrific. Okay, you've done an incredible job of describing the book, you know, from the sort of helicopter looking down. Is there something that we haven't covered in this conversation that was really central to you that you'd like us to end on?
I'm trying to think. Well, I think this book, you know, the thing that I would just want to end on maybe is to say that I think when I started out to write it, I thought that I could make a real contribution by bringing together some fields that are often not put together. So like I said, I'm a historian of science, but I was also interested in environmental history and animal studies. And I kind of learned the field of African-American history in graduate school. And I think that this book is one of a bunch of books that are coming out or like will be coming out that do kind of make these connections that I think are really important. And I do hope that people find the book to be useful as a kind of not interdisciplinary, but like bringing together these different fields that usually are not kind of in communication. And yeah, I think ultimately like my pitch for this book is that it is a material on the ground human animal history of dehumanization.
Perfect last sentence. And I will say in terms of who can use this book, I am in political science. I teach American political thought. I will assign part of this book next time for American political thought. It handles some of the documents. I'm already showing them, but it handles them in a different way. I'm not a historian of science, and I wouldn't teach as much of that, but you bring it in. This is accessible to a general reader. It's accessible to an undergraduate, and then it's an unbelievably challenging book for the people who are writing in these fields. And I thank you so much for taking the time to come talk to me about this. I've been talking to Chris Blakely. Their book is Empire of Brutality, Enslaved People and Animals in the British Atlantic World. It was published by Louisiana State University Press in 2023. Thanks so much, Chris.
Thanks for having me, Susan.